Tonight on Arena, Megalopolis, The Outrun and Will and Harper are the movies up for review. And Après Après Match, Gary Cook on his new play Billy Boggins, A Bathroom Story. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Megalopolis is an epic science fiction drama written and directed and produced by the legendary film director and maker Francis Ford Coppola. Decades in development, Coppola funded the project himself, which attempts to draw parallels between the fall of Rome and the future of the United States. The Outrun is an adaptation of Amy Liptrop's memoir of the same name. Saoirse Ronan plays Rona, a woman who struggles with alcoholism, and after going into rehab, she returns to her childhood home in the Orkney Islands. Papa Essidu and Saskia Reeves also star. And Will and Harper is a documentary about the longtime friends and collaborators Will Ferrell and Harper Steele. The two embark on a road trip across America to explore their changed relationship following Steele's decision to transition to female during the pandemic. Those are the three movies that we will be reviewing this evening in the company of Gemma Cray and Justin McGregor, both of whom are sitting opposite me right now. And for some reason, I've caught a little thing in my throat. Hopefully it will clear up as we go along. Let's start with Megalopolis. He's been dreaming of making this for decades. He was lucky enough to have $120 million in his back pocket, his own money that he put into this pet project, bringing it to fruition. Hollywood A-listers, Adam Driver, Lawrence Fishburne, Dustin Hoffman, Shia LaBeouf, John Voight, and I could go on for at least 3 or 4 minutes just with that list. Does it all add up to anything? We will have to find out, because there are lots of talk about this. I think you have a kind of a very simple way of, or straightforward way of, simplifying the rambling plot for us, Justin.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's art versus politics, and which does commerce fund? And the art is represented by Adam Driver's Caesar, and then we've got Giancarlo Esposito, who's Mayor Cicero, and then we've got John Voight, Hamilton Crassus III, who owns the bank that and owns the money that's in the bank that funds all this stuff. So it really is, on its very simple level, it's art versus politics, and how do the two meet? Can they meet? And there's a love story, you know, between the politician's daughter and Adam Driver to, of course, create a kind of Romeo and Juliet sort of feel to it.
And she's called Julia, the character played by Natalie Emmanuel.
Yeah, and she's called Julia. I mean, there's so many Easter eggs in here, and most of them are classical Greek philosophy. There's a Plutarch joke. There's not very many films that have Plutarch jokes in them. And it does. It has all this philosophy and all this filmmaking. There's homages to Hitchcock. You know, there's all these shots from other films that are in there. I mean, he's put every idea he's ever had into a single film.
I think the hint may be in that last part of that paragraph from Justin there, Gemma, because I was going to say to you, well, that's a fairly simple plot. All of those great actors. And yeah, OK, there are references there to all of these things if you spot them, particularly the Plutarch joke. Well done. Won't quiz either of you on that one. But I think it's very nicely summarised for us there by Justin. It perhaps isn't that straightforward, but we're watching the 2 hours and 18 minutes of it, Gemma.
Oh, no. There's no structure. There's no real character development. Even the form shifts so wildly. Like, you'll have these big out-of-place theatrical or metaphorical discussions between two characters that don't give any insight into the character. They might not even feel appropriate for that character. There's no real arc or change for any of the characters. On the outset, it's art versus politics. You have two cartoon villains. You don't even have one antagonist. It's like Spider-Man 3 syndrome all over again, where you're like, who do you dislike? Who's the bad guy? And then, yeah, you kind of have also this kind of ambiguous nod to populism, where Shia LaBeouf, when he tries to take Caesar down early on in the film with a deep fake, very convoluted plot that is sort of thwarted quite easily, and then later he decides he's going to become a politician. He's going to kind of rally the troops. He's a populist. He agrees with everyone. He starts to
wonder
gain
who the base that
power. Yeah, and then sort of teams up with Audrey Plaza's very, very strange Platinum Wow, who's like almost like a Jafar-esque villain whose sexuality, who uses her sexuality to like ensnare the head of the bank and kind of hypnotizes him with this like strange ability in order to try and control the money. And together they team up to try and take Caesar down. But if it wasn't for like the copious amount of sex, nudity, drug taking, if it wasn't so gratuitous, it almost feels like a untethered children's film.
Wow, that's quite an interesting leap. But we are talking here about the man who gave us the conversation, Apocalypse Now and The Godfather 1 and 2. Leave out 3 just for the purposes of this priz.
And that's all 1971 to 1979.
It's a long time ago, isn't it? Yeah.
But he had like that decade is it would be anyone else's career. But there's a little hint when he forms Zeotrope Studios, who's obviously the people who he gave them who's his studio, who he gave his money to fund his own film. He did make a movie in the early 80s called One from the Heart that was going to reimagine the Hollywood musical. It was very set driven. And it feels like those seeds were being planted there of him deciding, you know, he's the guy who also directs Jack, you know, with Robin Williams, that he's fighting this art versus commerce and really wants to do is just go, here's my art, love it or don't love it, but here we go.
But for those films in the 1970s alone, a lot of what I read was people either hating or loving this film in reviews, Gemma, but at the end saying, but it's Francis Ford Coppola, so, you know, I'm going to go and watch it because of that, because it's him. I'm going to go for that alone.
It's such an ambitious film. There's elements of it that are so beautiful. I will always respect people that will just go, this is like, it's mine. I'm going
and
to do it anyway.
And he has a big back catalogue. You could forgive him doing that.
Yeah. And I think that musical bankrupted him. So since then, all the projects that he's taken on has basically been to pay back that debt. He sold a winery to make this. He didn't just have that cash. Like, he sold a winery to make that and had a kind of...
But he had the winery.
Yeah, he did.
Small detail.
he got to cash that out. But no, so he kind of, like, he did invest a lot in it. But I suppose this is probably his last hurrah. I don't know. Maybe it will attract and take in a huge swath of cash that will pay off all his loans and buy him a brand new winery. But, like, I would be surprised.
Yeah, well, he might make a brand new film if he could make loads of cash off it. What are you saying in stars? And do you still think people should go and see it or not?
Okay, 2.5 because what? But I don't know. There's something weird and magical as well to it. Like, I would say go see it. It seems to be really divisive. And the performances, I don't know, like, there's something about, it doesn't take a turn that you expect. I don't know, like, you're not ever going to watch a film like this again, so you might as well give it a watch if you like film.
2.5, you're never going to watch a film like this again. Maybe not for the poster. Is yours going to be for the poster?
No, I think if you love cinema and if you love Francis Ford Coppola, I think it's worth just seeing what he was doing and what he's been thinking about for 40 years. And yeah, it's spectacularly great and it's spectacularly awful, all sort of in the same moment. But there's something at the end of it I just found really a bit spectacular, that he just went and did this. He threw caution to the wind and said, here's what's in my head.
Okay.
And it's amazing. I give it 4 stars. It's an homage to film.
An homage to film. That might go on the poster. All right, let's move on to the Outrun. First film produced by Saoirse Ronan and her husband Jack Loudon, he of the Slow Horses fame. The film tells the story of a woman called Rona who flees London following a stint in rehab for alcoholism. She returns to the wild and remote Orkney Islands and her family home, where she struggles to remain sober. The story reveals what happened in London through a series of flashbacks. Not just starring in this film, but producing it as well, our Saoirse, Jenna.
It's such a character and performance driven piece that you can really see an actor like rubbing their hands together with glee when seeing the concept. It's adapted from the autobiography of Amy Liptrot. It's a very personal story, authentically told. And upon saying that, it wouldn't be something that you would see on paper and say that would make a necessarily brilliant film, because it's not structured in a traditional plot way. It doesn't even manifest like that. And And it's quite experimental in form in how the story is told. It's not told beginning, middle to end. It's sort of fragments are revealed as she's processing her addiction, her past traumas, her relationship to her father. And it's so introspective. It's so based around her own performance. And she falters. On some level, she's not a particularly likable character. She's somebody who does really terrible things. She is cold and cutting to her warm, generous mother, kind Maybe of belittles her for her religion. But then you really do empathize with her because the performance is so deep, and you see the struggle and the failed potential. And then when we're introduced to her father, and who's going through a very kind of similar level of mental illness and suffering from it now, and sees the manifestation of that fallout in the present day, you can see how she's sort of, if she doesn't course correct, would be going down the same route. And again, Scotland in this is so beautiful. It's such a cinematic space.
Well, I'll come to the Scotland bit in a minute, because I presume the relationship with Danon, that's in London, that's quite early on. And it may not be early in the film, because it isn't, as you say, linear in the way it tells the story. But here is a scene between Saoirse Ronan as Rona and Papa Esidu as Danon, and obviously something horrible has happened the previous night.
What did I do last night?
You don't remember.
Danon, I'm sorry. Danon, I'm so sorry. Whatever I did, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm sorry.
And I'm so tired of hearing you say that. I can't hear you say that again.
What do you mean?
I don't even recognize you anymore. I wish you were a completely different person.
Don't say that.
I can't do this.
What do you mean you can't do this?
I just can't do this.
Did I do that to you? I'll never do that again, right? Whatever I did, I'll never do it again. I'm never going to drink again. I promise you, right? Because I don't want to lose you. I don't want to lose you. Please don't go. I love you.
Even just listening to that, that's Saoirse Ronan from The Outrun, and the partner, Danon, played by Papa Esidu. Even just listening to that clip, Gemma, you know, you can get the emotional intensity of it, and the absolute desperation, and you're kind of wondering, I don't believe you either that you're never going to drink again. But she does somehow make it to rehab, and then the film, it's not that suddenly everything moves to Scotland, because it flashes between London and Scotland right throughout the film. When she gets to Scotland, though, it's a whole different energy.
Yeah, so in many ways, when she arrives, she goes back into that classic child character with her, you know, like fighting with her mum, or, you know, kind of like having those kind of discussions with her dad. It was almost like she picked up and she sort of resents being there, and it like is uncomfortable. She knows everybody knows her business because it's a very, very, very small town. She's isolated. She tries to make friends over a cigarette in the street and realizes, you know, she's just hanging out with her mum and her mum's church group, which she's not a fan of, and feels judged. But when she goes to leave, she gets on the ferry and the first thing she sees is a bar. So she immediately turns around and goes back because she realises she won't make it if she's on her own.
And then Amy Liptrop wrote the memoir, so we know that things have turned out well for her. And she calls the character Rona here. I read something where she said she wanted that little bit of distance in the screenplay, so there's more fictionalised elements within this. So there's her involvement, Nora Finkscheid, who's the director, and Saoirse Ronan. Three hugely powerful women at the heart of making this film.
And again, I think there you can really get a sense of there's an investigation of creativity in this, because it doesn't have that same pacing that you would expect. It spends a lot of the period is Rona on her own in a room, or at one place when her things with her father breaks down, she moves to another even smaller island again, where she lives in this very, very
more isolated,
more isolated, because again the temptation there is too strong, and she's there completely by herself. And there's a moment like that we spend with her, quite a long period, which on paper again isn't really necessarily suited to film, but again the dynamics, the character, the and again how it's the physicality of the space is used is very representative of her own turmoil.
Lots of talk about Oscar buzz around Saoirse Ronan in this in particular. Did the film work for you, and would you recommend it, Gemma?
Absolutely brilliant. I think if someone is going in expecting like a traditional like woman overcoming adversity, happy, easy film, it isn't quite that. It's a little bit more taxing, more honest, but I think it's absolutely beautiful, and I think Saoirse is spectacular in it.
I shall let us hope that that does translate into Oscar, more than just Oscar buzz, Oscar reality, because she's been very close a couple of times at this stage. Let's move on. Did you give me stars there? You did, sorry.
Oh, four.
Four. Let's move on to Will and Harper, new documentary about the friendship between the actor Will Ferrell and his Saturday Night Live collaborator, Andrew Steele, as he was at the time they collaborated, but Harper Steele, as she is now. During the pandemic, Harper transitioned and now identified as females. Will Ferrell and Harper took a road trip from New York to LA to process this stage of their relationship. This is very close to the beginning of the film, when they're describing an email that Harper sent out to many of her friends, but in particular this one to Will. You'll hear Will Ferrell reading it first of all, and then it switches over to Harper Steele reading the second part.
When the pandemic hit, we didn't see each other for a long time. And then one day I was in the middle of shooting a movie in Boston, and I got this email from Andrew. Hey, Will. Something I need you to know. I'm old now, and as ridiculous and unnecessary as it may seem to report, I'll be transitioning to live as a woman.
In the last 10 years, I've been trying to understand what's going on, tried to get rid of it over and over again throughout my life, and now I'm giving up the fight. When I was young, I thought all boys felt like me. Then I thought, maybe I'm just a weirdo. Then I pushed it away for many years and ended up in therapy. It's a wonderful thing when your mind and body revolt against the unnatural, despondent thing you become. I doubt being a trans woman will change my personality that much. Instead of an asshole, I'll be a bitch. I think it's made me a lot happier.
I'd like to say my
And that is essentially, that is Harper Steele at the end of that, Will Ferrell at the beginning of that clip from Will and Harper. But that question at the end is, has transitioning to a woman changed her personality? That's the fundamental question that's been asked here by two friends. Like when Will Ferrell and the then Andrew Steele, which was really a cover-up for Harper, who was inside all the time, when they were working together, the friendship that grew between the creative friendship and the personal friendship is enormous, and that's at the heart of this movie, Justin.
No, absolutely. I mean, they go a little bit into some of the zany things they did. I mean, Will Ferrell spent a year in character behind the scenes at Saturday Night Live. Andrew at the time convinced him to make a film entirely in Spanish. Like, they just sort of fed these kind of creative impulses and grew closer and closer together. And then there's this pause in their friendship from COVID. And this, and I mean, you can hear how well written that email is. And Harper talks about how she wrote and rewrote and rewrote the email. And basically,
she's a writer.
She's a writer. And she sends it out one person at a time. You know, Tina Fey, she sends all these emails out to her sister and all these people. And Will Ferrell's question is, what does it mean for our friendship? Like, what's changed between us? What's changed in you? What will it change in me? And it's a very gentle question. And the film, if you're expecting like endless laughs, it's not that film. This is really about this friendship in a really, really serious way.
Yeah, because what's wonderful about the sections of it that I saw, Gemma, is the fact that Will Ferrell is asking the questions that many people who may have a friend or an acquaintance or a family member in the situation of Harper would want to ask. He asks those questions of Harper.
Yeah, he does. And like, I mean, Harper in interviews herself, she'll say, like, don't ask us about her genitalia. Like, it's not appropriate. But I think even those, that emotional thing about identity and about how you're perceived, I think there's a really beautiful moment in which Harper's sort of talking about how she sees herself in the mirror, and she's at an early stage. It's only been a couple of years, and you can see she's figuring it out as much as he is, and seeing her place. So part of it is part of the reason that they decide to go on this is because, like, when she lived as Andrew, she used to do these tours. She used to travel around and drink in dive bars and go to, like, you know, like trucking rallies and like
very
all these things.
Male, masculine things to be doing. But the risk that she takes is revisiting some of those places on this road trip, sometimes with Will Ferrell sitting beside her, sometimes without Will Ferrell sitting beside her. There are two very specific moments that very unexpected in many ways, I thought. The response...
There's one. I mean, there's a couple of them just sort of later in the film. And yeah, what's really interesting is it's not like Harper has all the answers and will ask the questions.
She's asking questions.
She's learning
as well.
The questions. Yeah. You know, she's going through this process of understanding them. But yeah, she goes to this biker's bar. And I mean, the first thing when you open the door is there's a flag that says Trump country and there's a flag beside it that says fuck Biden.
And that's I can't think of the Confederate flag is up there.
Confederate flag in there. And she tells Will she wants to go in by herself. She wants to know if she can still be that person. And she goes in and you are so nervous for her.
Yeah.
And somehow she's just very honest. She said, I'm transitioning. This is who I am. And people get interested, like, as they connect with her. And finally, she calls in Will Ferrell when she realizes it's safe. Then he comes in. And then, of course, they love her even more because, you know, she's friends with Will Ferrell. But then there's
But they have accepted her.
But they
totally
accept her. Meeting her, they accept her. But then they go to eat this restaurant for this 72-ounce steak. And they're kind of put up to it. And if Will Ferrell can eat it, you know, the steak is free. And you kind of eat it on a pedestal, like you're on stage. And Will Ferrell goes a Sherlock Holmes and then says, you know, I've been in a fishbowl my whole life. I've never been in a fishbowl like this. And everyone is just judging them from a distance.
But
they don't get that personal connection.
They don't. There's no connection. And then it's the online reaction.
The reaction is unbelievable. Like, it's just terrific.
Bilious.
Who's that creature sitting across from him? Like, it's really hard to read. And Harper's just reading them on the camping chair, having a beer the next day. And it's horrific. And you just see that it's that unknown that leads to all this fear and this anger and rage that's just completely misplaced.
Worth seeing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you often say, oh, this is a film whose time is now. But I think if you think people choose to transition, you have to see this movie. There's no choice here. It's a fascinating exploration. I gave it 5 stars.
Gemma?
This is something that actually has stuck with me in a way that I was very surprised by when I watched it, because it's so low key. There's beautiful, silly moments. There's Kirsten Wiig, Will Forte bringing their kind of classic humor to the all that kind of zaniness that you would expect. And the emotional moments aren't heightened. They're not intense.
Yeah.
They're not like these kind of big shifts that you'd get from reality TV. They're so quiet that afterwards, when you think about it, and I was really, really moved by how vulnerable she was going on this journey.
Yeah,
I
got
4 stars and I would recommend anyone watch
it. And it is available on Netflix, Will and Harper, whereas The Outrun and Megalopolis are in cinemas. And thank you to Gemma Cray and Justin McGregor for our film reviews this evening. We know him best from the heady days of RTE soccer punditry, Gary Cook, and in the satirical soccer sketches, Après Match had more Dunphy swagger than even the real Eamon Dunphy could muster. Now the stand-up come actor, writer, Gary, has written a play which gives us a nod to junior football management while exploring inter-family squabbling and the dodginess of some business dealings. It's called Billy Boggins, A Bathroom Story. It's directed by Barbara McQueeve, stars Gary Cook, as I say, opens at Beauty's Cafe Theatre in Dublin on Monday, and delighted that Gary Cook is sitting across the desk from me in the Arena studio this evening. You can't get away from the football. I see you had to have the junior football in there, Gary.
Yeah, well, football is never very far away from me, so it seemed like a good place to start, you know. So, I mean, it's not a play about football. But it does start there. It's a play really about a guy called Billy Boggins, who's a bathroom salesman and a dissatisfied one. And he manages a football under 12s football team called Baytown Boys. And he makes a decision at that football match, which will influence the whole rest of the play.
Yeah, absolutely. But where and how and when did you think, I'll write a story about a salesman? I mean, no less a person than Arthur Miller came at life from that angle beforehand. But a bathroom salesman, where did that come out of?
Well, there's something I was sort of very kind of funny about, you know, the idea of bathrooms, you know, because they, I mean, as they say, bathrooms and kitchens sell houses, you know. And I think in bathrooms, it's such a strange, because they're both incredibly functional and they're also incredibly personal. And it's a place where, you know, a lot goes on in a bathroom, you know. So I just thought, you know, how it's a kind of a metaphor for the whole of life, really. And I just thought it was a funny metaphor for the whole of life.
And certainly, I mean, even when I read Billy Boggins' A Bathroom Story, I thought, well, he's into the big end of the B alliteration here, you know. And what is the name of the club again? Bayside?
Baytown Boys.
Baytown Boys. And, so the bees are very important. And of course, he has a brother called Bobby, just to stick with that, who now calls himself Robert.
That's right. Yeah, because Robert's moved up the hill. Now, it's not necessarily, it could be anywhere in Dublin, so people can decide where exactly it is. But he's moved up the hill, as in, you know, to a posher place. And, you know, they come from a kind of, I suppose, quote unquote, lower middle class kind of background. And, you know, Billy's remained, you know, a fairly sort of normal kind of character, you know. Mm. And his brother has become slightly more, I suppose, attempting to be more refined.
Yes.
And so, but again, I mean, it's not a comedy of manners. It's really, there's a lot of internecine brotherly feuding.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fun in it. There's no question about it, and some great laughs and, you know, just situational comedy within the piece as well. But there is this family difficulty in that the two brothers, your character, Billy, kind of thinks he's running the business. He does all the sales. Bobby is running the business.
Yes, the brother Bobby is running the business, and he is the CEO of the business. And Billy's a salesman who probably, I would suspect, drinks a bit too much, who likes clinching, you know, deals with clients. But, you know, long after the deals have been clinched, I think he's a fellow who likes to stay in the pub and just, you know, he's lonely. He's a lonely man.
Yeah, he's separated.
He's separated.
And, he still has a reasonably good relationship with the ex-wife.
He does, yeah. I mean, yeah. And you know, at its, I suppose there's not so much the subtext because it's actually in the text. So,
yeah.
So, like, his mother's died. And he was very close to her, and in a sense that he's become disanchored, I suppose, to a degree, is what's going on. You know, I presume he's kind of quite a good crack sort of character.
Yeah, you'd want to have a pint with him, you certainly would. But into his life, we don't need to go into the machinations of how comes a real whiz kid.
Well, yeah, he's at the very beginning of the play, he is managing this team. There's a football match on, and he tells one of the kids to go down in the box. Now, you know, there's nothing unusual about that.
What?
I remember playing matches in the late 70s. And
please don't say where or with whom.
I won't say with whom, but where kids were told, I mean, if kids were being fouled and were getting lumps kicked out of them, you know, some of the adults would go, just go down at the box. They got a penalty. Now, on the basis that they were already being fouled, not, you know, kind of.
Yeah, just take a dive. Yeah.
So Billy suggests this to a Dutch lad called Andre Flatpak, a man who is on the parent of the opposing team. Parent of one of the players in the opposing team is very upset about this and very angry, and confronts him after the game. And the play really is about their relationship thereafter,
and
how it develops and what happens downstream of it.
Absolutely. And you're going to perform a little bit, which is Edward Duffy is the name of the man, the parent of the child who he feels has been wronged in this. And nothing like wronging something in an under 12 match. That's way worse than an international match or anything else.
So do you want me to read it?
Yes. Okay. So at this point, Edward, we know that Robert has told Billy, the brother has said, go over and apologise to him. Look, he's a big shot around the place. We might get a bit of money out of him. He's an important guy in town. And this is a meeting then that...
No. The bit that I've got here is actually at the big... I mean, that does happen. Mm. He does end up being told to apologise to this guy. But this is the beginning of the show, where leading up to the point at which he tells his kid to go down. So he's telling the story. He goes, we were playing a match and we had this lad, Andre Flatpak, a very technical player, Dutch. Anyway, Andre is getting lumps kicked out of him by this young fella, rugby player, 12 years old and 6'1", no word of a lie. And finally, I had enough of it. And I told Andre, if he did that again, to go down in the box. Like, not in a bad way, just go down. I mean, the kid was fine with it. Clever lad. Speaks 5 languages. Like, in anyone's language, that's a bleeding penalty. So, sure enough, your man, the rugby player, barricks into him again. Andre goes down, penalty, he scores. Yes, get in there. Uproar on the touchline from the parents. Where's the TMO? It's VAR, actually. Where's the solicitor when you need one? Sure, you are the bleeding solicitor. You know, just a bit of banter. Anyway, we won. And my brother Bobby shakes hands, but he gives me the look and he says he has to run. So I'm there with Lair, you know, assistant coach. And this fella marches over. Little fella, big hair, bigger attitude, in a Crombie, Southside accent. And he starts accusing me of cheating. You were at it all game, you know, trying to fool the ref, all that soccer stuff. I go, what are you talking about? Your lad was taking lumps out of our lad. Would you get away with that? But he jabs his finger in at me. He goes, I saw what you did to that kid. You told him to go down in the box, which, to be fair, is true. But I'm not admitting to anything. And I'm thinking de-escalation. So I go, nice to meet you, Billy Boggins. And you are... I am Edward Duffy, and that boy you tried to fool is my son. What, the tall fella? Are you sure he's yours? And he doesn't like the insinuation, and he squares up to, like, make a go at me. So I sort of make half a go back at him, because, like, I'm not one to back down. And Lair, bless him, goes, come on now, lads, will you stop? You's a grown man. And Edward glares at me, and he goes, this won't be forgotten. I can promise you that.
Jeepers, you looked at me there and I thought you were saying it directly to me. That's Gary Cook as Edward Duffy and as Billy Boggins in the midst of all of that as well. That's from his play, Billy Boggins, A Bathroom Story, which will be performed in Bewley's, which also begins with B. I'm just noticing as well, seems to be a theme. But the switching there, Gary, from Billy and his accent into Edward Duffy and that quite definite Southside style of things. You know, do you, when you're doing something like this as an actor, as opposed to in the impersonations from Apres Match and things like that, do you have specific people in mind, or does it become a character that you're finding an accent for? How do you approach that?
I went into a bathroom showrooms
research.
Research, and the bloke who I met sounded and looked exactly like I'd expect Billy Boggins to look. He was kind of like one of those blokes, you know, he's going, yeah, I know we've got really, really nice chrome faucets in, you know, and it was all that stuff. And it's research, yeah. Talking to people is research.
Did you kind of clock him and think, there's my Billy Boggins voice, listen carefully and start rehearsing the minute you get into the car, getting his voice?
Not exactly, but he just sounded exactly like that. And, you know, and I know I come from north side of Dublin, and I know quite a lot of guys. You know, there was quite a lot of blokes, you know, on the north side of Dublin, kind of spoke a little bit like that, you know, and they had that kind of way about them. You know, someone who became salesman, and they were kind of almost quite, you know, quite aspirational in the kind of way that they talked, you know, and you actually hear that quite a lot with the, you know, some of the football type of guys, you know, and all of it just feeds into the mix. But I mean,
Edward, did you go over to somewhere on the south side then for a little bit of research there.
Edward Duffy is based on a composite of characters that I know, some of whom I'll tell right to their face.
Yeah, and please, no, again, don't mention their names either.
I mean, look, you know, the difference with this is that it's kind of got to fit into a much longer narrative than if you're doing sketches. You've a sketch, and obviously that sketch has got to have its punchline and all that kind of stuff. It's not a free for all either. But you know, this stuff has got to work over an hour.
Yeah, and it goes into dark areas as well. But again, there's no point in us going too far down that. I will give too much away. But I do want to play a bit of this.
Can I ask you this question? Why are we so popular, huh? Do you think?
I think I'm so popular because I know the game. They see me as their sage. Now, once again, John is correct. He's right. You see, we've got charisma, we've got style, we've got panache, and Liam, he's a scaldy tops. He's good company, the guy.
Scaldy? At least I didn't forget me tie.
I didn't. I forgot. I don't do them. No.
Toys, John?
Personally, I like my own tie. I've gone for the classic bus conductor look, you know, nice straight lines.
I'm just trying to work out why we're so popular. The ratings are through the roof. Huh?
Well, the reason.
No, Liam. See, some of us are irresistible.
I'd say I'm the most popular, though, wouldn't you?
Ivan's got really nice teeth there. I remember seeing him once when he smiled.
I've got nice teeth.
See, never mind these guys. I spent a fortune on my teeth, nearly as much as I lost in Brazil. You know? And that's quite a lot of money. It's a lot of money, Bill. You know?
There we have a brave match.
Yeah.
Gary Cook, as both Johnny Giles and Dunphy and Eamon Dunphy in the mix of that.
Yeah, they were. That was actually a dub we did of edited footage of them.
So Bill O'Herlihy, Johnny Giles, Liam Brady and Eamon Dunphy were on the screen, and you guys came up with the script and overdubbed
it. Right. It was so we mouthed what they looked like they were saying. You know, and so on. So some of those sketches, we did a couple of those style of sketches every time, and they always worked really well. If they're good, they work really well, you know. So the kind of dubbing sketches of.
Yes.
And there was, you know, Brady had at one point, you know, he'd kind of like really crowned teeth, actually. And so did Dunphy. They look like they've gone to Turkey, actually, for a special teeth treatment.
We don't know that they did, but they look like they don't care. Yeah.
They looked like they might have. So that was that's why he's talking about the teeth, you know. And Brady had a bit of a goofy kind of grin in this particular clipping. So just in case people were wondering what they were talking about, that was a dubbed thing.
So the visuals were the very fine teeth.
Exactly.
So you just had to, the script.
So we did. Exactly.
The script had. But writing that, I guess it was yourself, Richard Cooper and
Barry Murphy.
Murphy. The three of you, I presume, were involved in the writing of all of it.
Yeah, we were. Yeah. I mean, some of it was very heavily written and some of it was kind of riffed around an idea sometimes. But it was definitely, you know, we try to make it as fresh as we possibly could. Yeah.
Is that a very different exercise then
when you came
to writing this by yourself, sitting down, visiting several bathroom showrooms until you got certain things in research. But writing this by yourself, was that a very different feeling?
Yeah, it was. It is. You spend a lot of time writing. Maybe some people don't, but I did. And I had a friend initially... at the very early stages of it, a friend of mine who's a businessman, but called Eamon Keaveney, and he's a good pal, and I ran some ideas by him, and he was very helpful to me, very generous in his time, and so it kind of went from there, and over a period of 6 months, maybe 3 or 4 months, I wrote it, and then at various stages over the next 6 months, I rewrote it, but I'm still rewriting it. Myself and Barbara are still rewriting.
Barbara McCabe, who's directing.
Well, because you've just, you know, when you're doing stuff and you're thinking that it's just too long, it's too long, get to the point. I mean, you were an actor, you know, and you're thinking, come on, just make it better. You know, when you're at a show and you're going, hurry up, you know, get this thing, get to the good part quickly. So, you know, you're always kind of bearing that in mind. And that's what makes it very, very difficult, you know, this stuff. To make it really, really sharp. I was involved in writing a thing with a fellow called Malachy McKenna. He's a really great writer. He won several awards. And we wrote a thing called Macbeth. And it was really good, except just when you were doing it, you were thinking, It needs to get to it needs to get to the thing quicker, but there's nothing you can do about it now because it's up and running and it's like, you know, so that ship has sailed.
Do the rewriting before it's up and
running.
Well,
writing is rewriting, as they say, yeah.
Well, there you go. And we're out of time. I better get on with it as well. Gary, great to see you. Great to speak
nice
with you.
See
lovely
you.
To listen to the Aubrey Match stuff again.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know. He's done, that guy, he's doing a play now, isn't he? Now, yeah, he's doing a play, yeah. He's in Bewley's. Yeah,
he's in Bewley's and he's Billy Boggins in this particular manifestation. Billy Boggins, A Bathroom Story, written and performed by Gary Cook, directed by Barbara McKeeve. Bewley's Cafe Theatre, Monday, September the 30th through until October the 19th. You'll find out full information on bewleyscafetheatre.com. Percussion ensemble Bangers and Crash have an exciting series of concerts coming up in Cork, Carlow and Galway over the next couple of months. It's a programme of percussion works, established and new. Promises, we are told, a captivating fusion of virtuoso performance and collaborative participation. Features a brand new composition by Belfast composer and conductor Brian Irvine. And Brian himself describes this as a series of concerts, an irresistible invitation to embark on a wild, sonically rich adventure. Delighted that Brian joins me on the line from Belfast. I think it's you're in Belfast this evening, Brian. This new piece that you're working on, when you say that it's an irresistible invitation, you're looking for a colony of humans. I have never seen a piece for percussion and a colony of humans before. I've never heard it.
Well, there you go. That's as good a reason to come as any.
Explain what you mean when you're asking for this colony of humans, Brian.
So the piece really began by an article that a friend of mine sent me about a scientific document which discovered some markings on acacia seeds in an ant colony and proposed that the markings were a way that the ants were communicating with each other, and also proposed that they could be also proposed what those markings might mean, and raises the question about, is this a kind of communication, a form of communication, or do ants make art? And so it got me thinking about sort of methods and ways of communicating through sound and about exploring that palette of what communication is, what sound is, you know, and also what truth is, because it all might be made up.
Yeah, that the ants, you are looking at this possibility that the ants are just having a bit of fun and doing a bit of a picture and a pattern on the ground, and it's nothing got to do at all with communication.
Very possible. They could just be doing some art. But so anyway, it got me thinking about, I do a lot of work with kind of any age, any ability, any instrument kind of orchestras. And so this piece, I wanted to make for six percussionists and a colony of humans of any age, any ability, any instrument, anything that makes a noise, including instruments and beyond. And then I sculpt this piece using different kind of communication methods, but essentially we all become one big noise machine.
So the sextet of percussion players is my favourite name, I have to say, for any ensemble. Bangers and Crash. It really is a clever name, isn't it?
It's really loud and hungry.
So are their parts quite set in place, and then this colony of worker players or worker ants, to continue that, this colony who come in are given a little bit more free rein, or is the entire thing quite free rein?
No, really, the percussion, the sextet have a very fixed score, which is led by Alex Petku, and then I conduct the colony, and the two scores run simultaneously.
So you're looking after the colony. But it's not just that the colony turn up on the day and let's start banging and hitting whatever instruments we have. There's a bit of preparation involved here.
Well, I work with them and the percussion group for a couple of hours for the 3 days leading up to the performance. And so we develop different communication methods. But I should stress as well that it's really what happens is the whole group becomes a kind of very weird and wonderful and enigmatic orchestra, because the people bring their instruments, or they bring, you know, their cello, but they may also bring their pots and pans, or they may also bring, you know, their cat, whatever, you know, whatever it is, because it's all, in the end, it's all noise.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what you're looking at. The, you know, we decide that, oh, music can only be made by cellos, violins, guitars, yes, whatever. But in fact, you would argue, I would be pretty certain, that music can be made by anything that's capable of making a sound.
Absolutely. I mean, it's essentially a core form of communication. We all use sound in some ways to communicate, and language and so on. So it's really about the exploration of what sound is and what music is and what communication is.
Let's have a listen to, obviously we can't listen to this piece because it only happens when it actually happens on the day, as it were.
It's exactly,
different every time that you do it. But I have a piece of yours here, one of your works, Montana Strange. Tell us a little bit about this, and we listen to a little section of it. Just tell
this
us a bit.
This is a piece.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. It uses the same kind of layering process, L-A-Y-E-R-I-N-G process, that combines an orchestra with a colony of 12 instrument noisemakers and an improviser, saxophonist improviser. So it layers up, and those. Montana Strange has like two scores going at the same time, one that I conduct and then one that the other conductor conducts. So it's the same processes.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to a little section of it, and we'll certainly hear the saxophone feature quite heavily within this. So there's a little section there from Montana Strange, composition by Brian Irvine. Brian on to us tonight talking about upcoming performance of A Dream. That was an extract from that particular piece. An upcoming performance with the Bangers and Crash Percussion Sextet, which will be happening around the country. But I was struck within that, and I wondered how much this has to do with improvisation and the two ensembles that you're talking about. Unfortunately, I spoke over just the beginning where it's quite quiet.
That's good.
And then it gets into that very chaotic piece in some ways, cacophonous section. And then it goes back down to this kind of calm, very melodic and very lyrical passage. I guess that's a certain. Does that have to do with the two ensembles and what's going on, Brian?
Yes, I mean it's really like it's like sort of balancing two sort of sonic mobiles or something, and so they go into all sorts of different areas. You know, moments that are kind of tender and funny to moments that are, you know, frustrated and angry and irritating, and all these sort of different corners of what it's essentially like to be a human being. So like it's all noise in some ways, and it's all up for grabs. You know, you might hear fragments of a tiny little violin, you know, piece that a 7-year-old is playing on a violin, but then it might go to something else. You know, it's a massive kind of weird jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, and it's interesting that alongside the participatory program that you're going to do with Bangers and Mash, where you have your colony of local people and local players involved, You have the Bangers and Crash Ensemble are giving us a programme that includes music for Pieces of Wood by Steve Reich, which of course picks up on the same theme as you're talking about. Bring whatever you want.
That's it, you know. And actually, the programme is beautiful. It's a beautiful piece by another Irish composer called Emma
O'Halloran. Yes.
And I think the whole night is like, I don't think you can get more of a sort of wider spectrum of sound, you know, because when you look at the stage, you have the kind of setup of Bangers and Crash, which is just an extraordinary thing to look at. And then we have, you know, up to 50 people bringing all sorts of things. And so you'll pretty much never have heard anything like this.
Yeah, you may not even have seen an ensemble made up of such instruments. Finally, I know you're always have a load of stuff on the go, Brian. What else is happening for you at the moment?
I'm working on a new opera with John Michael Duff, who I work with a lot in Dumbworld, and developing a new piece with Nisha Jones, who I did an opera with at the with Irish National Opera. And I have a number of pieces kind of touring. We have projected opera pieces happening all over the place, and a couple of film projects as well. So lots going on.
Lots going on. And I'm going to give out the soundwavesmusicspace.com, and that's where people, when something's coming to their locality, they can check out how to become part of the colony, the colony of musicians.
Absolutely. You know, and again, I encourage anyone to bring any instrument. You know, it can be a traditional instrument. It can be anything, essentially.
Or anything you think can make a noise, bring it with you.
Exactly.
Brian, thanks so much for being with us this evening. That's Brian Irvine. And Bangers and Crash will be at the Everyman in Cork on the 1st of October. Carlo Visual on the 10th of November. The Black Box Theatre in Galway on the 24th of November. Few workshop places left if you feel inclined to get involved and you want to bring something that has never been heard as a musical instrument before, but you believe can be one. You'll find out full information on that website, soundwavesmusicspace.com. All one word, soundwavesmusicspace.com. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.